Blog Talk Radio.
It's to you.
Have you ever lost yourself in some chronic family crisis, giving and giving until you feel as if there's no more left to give, and yet you give more? Out of love, out of duty, or out of obligation? What would happen if you changed that pattern and took care of yourself first? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, spiritual relationship healer, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love. Author of the Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me book series, the romantic novel Love in the Blizzard of Life, and creator of Healing Through Love seminars and my special 30 Love Lessons for the Soul. And I have an upcoming summit, a virtual summit about women and love. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with a lady, Jodi Prowse, whose book I really was engaged reading. I started reading it and I couldn't put it down. I kept looking forward to the next chapter. So that was wonderful. She is the embattled woman's champion. She helps women recognize that they do have the strength to transcend family trauma, and they have the power to disengage from codependency with those family members who are at the heart of a lot of drama. Jodi spent more than 30 years seeking to protect her brother, who was ultimately lost in alcoholism. She gave so much it nearly cost her her marriage and risked endangering her children's mental health. Her gripping and powerful story is told in her book, The Sun Is Gone, A Sister Lost in Secrets, Shame, and Addiction, and How I Broke Free. So I have the pleasure of introducing you. Welcome, Jodi Prowse.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Yeah, I would love to hear your story, your early family experiences, later relationships. What led you to finally realize the effects of the alcoholism and of the way your family may have been handling it and you're breaking free from its grip? Tell us your story, just real briefly, and then we'll talk
more. For sure. I'll tell you why I decided to write the story to begin with. I'd been surrounded by alcoholism my whole life. It's on so many branches of our family tree. But when my brother became addicted to alcohol, it had become so out of control and heart-wrenching that I didn't think anyone could believe that alcohol could do this. And so, I became enthralled in my brother's life. And, you do it out of love and to help them, and you're there for the people that you love. And it just took control over everything in my life. But what I didn't know then was how much our childhood impacted us and perhaps set the stage for this disease of alcoholism. What we didn't know then when we went to the doctors and the treatment centers and talked to the therapists was how much of an impact childhood trauma can have on a child. And in their later lives, they can have anxiety and depression and other more serious mental health issues, and that can also lead to drug and alcohol addiction. And, you know, that was one of the pieces of the puzzle that was missing. And I just thought I wanted to write the whole story. My book starts when my brother is 2 and I'm 6 years old, and it takes us through the whole 40-year progression. And so the world
I have
and the
to
reader,
add something. Jody, I'd like to add something here. That's what made it so powerful, because so often we see someone who's got any kind of mental or physical problem, and we think they've always been that way. We don't realize how he started out as a precious little baby and child and sweet person. He wasn't always this out-and-out alcoholic.
Yeah, and I, you know, for my own healing through this journey, I've probably read about 30 addiction and mental illness memoirs. And it did all, you know, most of the time they're written by the addict in recovery, of course, with a happy ending. But it was just such a partial glimpse. I did, for that exact reason, want to show the whole story that perhaps could change some people's minds, that they could have some compassion and empathy and understanding and love. Everybody's born, and you know, you have parents that are so happy to have this beautiful little baby, and you just don't realize that some things happen to these children that can lead them down this path. And that is really what I wanted to create.
And what happens is you have this trauma at a young age, and everything may seem to be going okay until you run into a problem, until
you
lose a job that really mattered to you, or you lose a spouse.
Well, the thing about trauma is it's not something I don't think a lot of the times you know that you even suffer from. I will say my brother had no memory of some of the early things that we witnessed, like the fighting and the dysfunction and the things that came out of an alcoholic home. I was older. I remembered those things, and it made me a different person. I became strong and stoic and able to take on the world. But I remember how scared and terrified my little brother was. And, you know, during his teenage years when he was shy and quiet and started having symptoms of anxiety and a little bit of depression, you certainly don't ever think, oh my gosh, this is from my childhood. And then what happens is, you know, you're with your buddies and you go off to college or university and you start drinking, and it takes that away. And I think that's what happens with a lot of people, is they don't really recognize what's going on. And a lot of it, of course, is shame. They don't want to tell anybody how they're feeling, certainly if it's a mental health issue.
Wow. And the other thing is, I've trained in a lot of different kinds of body therapy, and I know how much is stored in our body. And I had a friend who was alcoholic, and I gave her a session of body therapy, and she said it was the first time she felt relaxed without the alcohol. So
and
a lot of times the person is self-soothing.
Yes, I think a lot of time they're self-soothing. And the thing is, that will work for a while until it possibly becomes a problem. I mean, it's no different than self-medicating, you know, with prescription medication and alcohol. And the unfortunate part is, you know, we have so much knowledge in 2017, but what we don't know is why some people, of course, can drink and drink occasionally, maybe drink more than other people, and why some people become so profoundly addicted to it. And, of course, that is what happened in my brother's case.
Well, some of it can be genetic. You can have a genetic predisposition, but there's also the environment. You know, what he grew up with.
Absolutely. And I think for us, You know, it's all of those things combined. You know, I even talk about, I wanted to be really honest with our heredity and our family. In my story, I even talk about my own son in grade one, developed severe anxiety and depression, had to be medicated, had to talk to a psychiatrist. And we, some of those things that I saw early on, now because of this experience with my brother, I really had my eyes wide open when it came to my own children, if they developed any of these kind of signs or symptoms.
So you're working to prevent it from continuing into the next generation.
That's exactly what I'm trying to do, and I'm really encouraging other families to speak out about addiction and mental illness in their own family. You know, we hide. And it's a disease, and the law says it is, and science proves it. But I think in families, we don't treat it like it's a disease. And so I tell this story for others, but also in hopes that my own family and the children that will come after myself and after my children and my nieces and all those people are made aware that alcoholism runs in our family tree.
So an important concept that you talked about is behavior of enabling and codependency. Can you explain, you know, we all know those terms, but what do you mean by them?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, I spent 6 years just on a mission to save my brother. And I thought, you know, I was doing all the right things. I don't drink. I like to think, you know, I'm educated in this. I was going to some of his therapy with him. I was reading books. I had such a handle on this. And then all of a sudden, when I got to my lowest point, when he wasn't getting well, and I was sacrificing my husband and my own sons and my own health, I was just at such a low point, I realized, oh my gosh, I don't know anything after all. And, you know, I always knew enabling, it's one of those statements where, you know, don't give money and don't pay rent and don't do things they can do for themselves and, you know, don't call in sick for a grown adult man. And I want to emphasize all those things were going on in my family. I wasn't doing any of those things. That was my clear understanding. Stepping back, I realized that I was going to all the meetings and I was the one changing and he wasn't doing the hard work and I was cleaning up his house for him every time, you know, he would go off to treatment. And I thought that was supportive. And what I think now is, you know, I was an enabler as well. But I very much was a codependent in that our family had such dysfunctional patterns. You know, I was made the caregiver of my siblings and my mom and at a very early age. I had poor boundaries, and I was a people pleaser and a caretaker, and I just sacrificed my own needs to help my family. And, you know, family, that word is such a funny thing because, of course, I love my parents and I love my brother and my sister. But ultimately, I have my own life and ultimately I'm responsible, you know, at that time for my two young children that were at home. And I really did put them in harm's way on this journey. And, you know, one of my biggest lessons is if I could rewind, I would tell everyone that's actively involved to get help for themselves first. And that we're not responsible for our addicted loved one getting well. We are not. But I do think what we do can diminish their chances of getting well.
So what could you do differently? When you love someone and they don't have money, and, you know, and you want to just pay the rent so they're not out in the street, what can you do differently?
You know, that's the thing about love is it gets in the way. it gets in the way, I think, of doing the right thing and following the advice of the professionals. I will say my brother did lose his battle with alcohol addiction in March of 2012. And I hear so many times people say, you know, I can't let my loved one or my child be homeless. And I would give anything today if my brother was homeless. And I mean that out of nothing but love, because maybe that would have been the one thing that made him really realize it was as bad as it was, and he would take it seriously and follow the advice of the professionals.
And that's why they say the person has to hit rock bottom.
But it's so scary because,
you know, they can die in that situation.
And, you know, I had someone that talked to me once that was going through, you know, some struggles, and they said to me, Jody, were you ever worried your brother was going to die? And I said, every minute of every day for 12 years. And that is the thought that makes us do these unhealthy things that's not best for them. I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a therapist, and I'm not a PhD. And so all I can do is tell you what went wrong in our journey and encourage you to go see those people and listen to what they tell you to do and find the strength. You know, just like when our addicted loved one goes to treatment and rehab centers, they're told what to do. We have to trust that those people know much more than we do. And,
wow. You
know, I used that for my strength. I did draw that healthy boundary with my brother in 2006. He would pass
and
away 5 years later.
But what did you do to set the boundary?
Well, I through therapy and through books, I finally gathered all the strength I had, and I told my brother that I would only continue to help him if he took sobriety and recovery seriously and wanted to make the changes in his life. And, you know, unfortunately, that meant I didn't really see him that many times in the last 5 years. But where I got my strength, I think, is I really thought if he were to die, the only way I could live with myself without having guilt is knowing that that was the only option for him. Recovery and sobriety and change was the only option.
That's really powerful what you said. Wow.
Thank you.
Now, most people don't think that. They just don't think like that. Yeah.
And you love them so much. And I have to say to anyone going through this in the world, someone out there understands how you feel. I mean, you feel so alone. We're not telling anybody. We're scared of judgment towards us. We're scared of judgment towards the one we love. We are so incredibly lost. But I so much believe in recovery. I mean, there's 5 million people in recovery in the United States and over 3 million in Canada. Those are statistics that are real. And I do.
You mean
believe
that are
in that.
Continuing, excuse me, they're continuing to recover. They're not like first time, you know, just short-term recovery.
No, they're in active recovery where, they're sober and through all different ways. I mean, there is AA, there is books, everyone, there is, some choose God, some don't. Like you had just said, you know, some do meditation. The biggest thing is finding out what works for you. There's no one-size-fits-all approach for anything, but that all that should be celebrated. And I very much hope that my story is still a powerful and story of hope and not something where someone just loses their battle. You know, not everyone survives cancer either, but we certainly can learn from some of the things that don't work.
So I have a question. What was the effect on your husband and your children when you were, maybe describe how you were enabling your brother. Like, were you running out of the house? Were you leaving the children alone? Like, what was happening?
For those 6 years, I neglected my own young sons. And at the time, you know, they were 10 and 12, and then, of course, they would start getting older. My husband always knew how much I loved my brother and how deep our bond was, because my husband and I had always talked about both of our childhoods. And so out of love for me, he let me just do my thing where my brother was concerned. But we should have both together drawn some healthy boundaries, you know, a long time before. I'll tell you a little story. When my son, my oldest son was 14, my brother cut his wrists and showed up at the house. My son was home alone. And everything you can imagine ensued, right? Having to call 911 and clean up. And what did I do when I heard, when he phoned me on my cell? Well, I ran to the hospital. And I remember getting home late that night, and my husband didn't say a word to me. And when I walked into the living room, in his calm tone, he said, "You know, Jody, you rushed to the hospital to make sure your brother was okay, but you never once called to make sure your son was okay." And I talk about that in my book, of such regret. See, none of us can go back. And my love for my brother was propelling me in one direction. But when I tell that story, it's like, what was I thinking? And, you know, I should have drawn a boundary then or even before then. But I also should have got my own son some help and some counseling and some therapy. And for that, I failed in my parenting. But all I can do now is learn from it and apologize.
But you didn't understand. You thought, well, my son is okay. You know, you don't realize he was okay, but that incident could make him not feel okay. You know, he was functioning fine, your son.
Exactly, which is exactly what we're discussing. And you do think you're doing everything right. And my son was looked after. His dad is there for him, so I don't have to worry about that. But now being able to step back, I think I always knew what those violent fights and being in an alcoholic home, how they changed my brother and I. And so that, what my son witnessed, had the potential to now change him as he moved through his teenage years and into adulthood and could show some lasting effects. And those are the things you definitely don't see then. You're not thinking clearly. You, like I said, that love and that being scared that your loved one is going to die, just, you're lost.
Well, you want to stop them from dying, from doing the destructive thing, and you forget the people that are reasonably healthy that need you.
It's
sad.
That's very, very
what
true.
Happens.
It is sad, you know, and so many other things are going on, you know, during all of this. I mean, our family, they started blaming and, you know, fighting, and this journey just rips families apart. I mean, you hear about that, and relationships don't survive, and marriages don't survive, and it's incredibly sad for everyone, which is why you do all need to get help and to become a little bit healthier.
Well, that's why so many treatment programs. I did a virtual summit on healing recovery, and so many of the speakers talked about the family programs, that the addict can't do it all alone. The whole family needs to get involved and understand, you know, and do their own counseling.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the family first, there was never any family involvement in any. My brother went to rehab 6 or 7 times, and through some of them had family programs, and he didn't want our participation, and which shows his mindset at the time, which is extremely sad. I mean, he didn't believe it was as bad as it was. But I so much do believe the whole family needs to get involved. And to find the courage to actually say, it's not that we're blaming our parents or we're blaming other people, but to find the courage to say, hey, listen, I might be part of the problem here. What do I need to do? And use that same love and that same understanding that your loved one could die to give you the strength to make those changes as well. And unfortunately, our family just wasn't doing that.
Yeah, as you were saying that, he may not only have felt like it's not that bad, but he may have felt no one in the family will really ever change or will ever really understand this. So he didn't, because he was thinking if they get involved, they're going to stay the same.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I also think, you know, there's addiction in some of the other branches of our family tree. And so it's very hard mm-hmm. to break free from that. You know, I remember him always coming back and you know, he'd be good for a while, of course, and saying, I need to find sober friends and positive influences and all those things. But, you know, a really sad piece of all this is, what happens when some of those people that surround you, those unhealthy people or those addicted people, are your family, the ones that you love more than anything else in this world? That just adds a whole other component to how hard this journey is. You know, I think for ultimate, if my brother was ever going to get well, I think he would have had to distance himself from some of our family.
And it's not only the people that you love, the addict loves these people, it's also the people that give him support, that pay bills or that listen to him. You know, they, on the one hand, they give support, and on the other hand, they're doing something to add to the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is where, like, I got my strength and I was confident. You know, I'm still left. Some days I'm better than others. I mean, it's been 5.5 years since he passed away, but I'm still left with that mm-hmm. grief and that loss, and I've had to work really hard to move past it and try to have this have some sort of a happy ending for, you know, for somebody else.
Mm. I guess that's the hope, that it wasn't all a waste and that somebody else can benefit from your understanding of this.
Yeah, and that is what gives me peace. And, you know, there is so many messages in my book of, you're right, codependency and shame and heredity and trauma and mental illness. But it is also just a complete love story, and it is full of hope, and it's full of forgiveness and really, you know, understanding and that happy ending for another family. If anyone sees themselves with all, you know, I call us characters, but we're not characters. We're real people in a real life
mm-hmm.
story. But if you're any one of those people in my story, you do need to change in some way. And that is, you know, included myself. I mean, like I said, I thought I had this under control. I was doing all the right things. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, my brother was addicted to alcohol, and I was addicted to my brother. And I think it just,
mm-hmm.
from being that little girl that would, you know, crawl into the bunk bed with him when he was 2 years old, when, you know, and promise him everything was going to be okay. And, you know, that took me through. I carried that through almost my whole life. And it's very hard to come to terms with, I'm not responsible for someone else. You know, that's a very hard reality to learn, because I thought I was, and I thought I failed him for a very long time.
Mm. Yeah, so that leads to another question, especially feeling that way, that you're responsible for someone else. How do you continue to take care of yourself when you feel responsible And then that person and other people tell you that you're selfish, you're not caring, maybe they even say you're being cruel. How do you do that? How do you keep taking care of yourself?
Well, for me, I had the loving support of my husband. I went to therapy. I am such a firm believer in therapy. It saved my life during this journey. And then I also read books on codependency and books on self-healing and books that I am enough. And because you are so right, I mean, you talk about other people, and when I would say I don't see my brother, and you would just, you can't tell everyone the whole story. And I did hear things like, you abandoned him and you deserted him. But I knew in my heart that's not what I did. And so I just had to gather strength, knowing that I know the truth. And for all those reasons we talked about, I knew that I could live with myself. You know, that's our story, unfortunately, is, you know, one of those textbook cases where the family turns on each other. And, you know, I became estranged from my parents and my sister. And, you know, when I drew that line to them at the time, I was abandoning my family. But I had to make the decision for myself and for the well-being of my own children.
And you had your own family. So which family do you give your loyalty to when you have to make a choice?
I know. And the sad part is, I mean, that's why we throw out those words family. But ultimately, if you are made to choose, who do you have to look after first? But I will say, even though I had to make that painful choice, I had to say, I have to look after myself and my own family. We should not forget that that was better for my brother as well. That I shouldn't have been so in, you know, and I really, really believe that. I think from the very beginning, I mean, this was a 12-year battle. I think from the very beginning, if he had to take more responsibility for himself instead of some of all of us kind of shielding him from the things that were going on, I think that really could have made a huge, huge difference.
But I see it as so common that they don't take responsibility. There's some reason going way back that someone doesn't take responsibility. And they maybe latch on to those people who do take responsibility. It's amazing.
And
so it's disempowering.
It is disempowering. And when you shield, even you think about it, you know, we teach our little children lessons and they learn from consequence. And, you know, it's up to us to create stable and, you know, hardworking and hopefully kind and compassionate and functioning adults. But we do that from consequence and us teaching them and life's lessons. And I think it's no different with your addicted loved one, only you get lost. They do need to have some consequences for if they're doing some things that are getting them into trouble. And maybe it is those consequences that will finally have them say, okay, I'm going to take this seriously and I'm going to get help.
It's so true. And so you say in your book at some point that going to support groups and treatment programs can actually be an enabling factor. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, my brother Brett used to joke that I'd went with him 100 times. And although I don't know the real number, over the 6-year period, my goodness, I'd been to so many different meetings and yes, treatment centers and counselors and therapists. And I think what I meant is I would still do those things, only not as actively involved as I was. You know, I would do those things and then expect that he would follow through and still have some change. And that was really never happening. You know, I will say a whole bunch of things went wrong for us and our family. And one of them, this was the year 2000 that it had started. I do think my brother needed more help with his mental health issues. I think the world's progressed and we know more now, and that he didn't know then. I mean, he did go, like I said, to 6 or 7 treatment centers, but they were all to stop drinking. If I could go back, I think the best place for him would have been a place that dealt with concurrent disorders, that dealt with mental health mm-hmm. issues, and the drinking at the same time. So that, I think, is very, very important to acknowledge. You know, if your loved one just, you know, keeps going to rehab or just doesn't stop drinking, maybe you do need to look a little deeper into some mental health issues. But having said that, my brother still would have need to made the commitment to make the changes in his life and work through the pain and the trauma and not continue to self-medicate.
Right, because there is pain. There's a lot of pain that you have to face. And the pain is not necessarily the pain of the alcohol. It's the pain of your childhood, the things you never really acknowledged.
Yeah, childhood, or maybe something else happened to you when you're older, or just any sort of traumatic event that could actually be the cause of why some of this is happening. And, you know, through my journey, I had to do all those things. Although I don't drink, I had to still deal with the pain. And, you know, it took me 3 years to write my book. And for 2 of those years, I cried almost every day, just reliving all those moments, the good and the bad. It's still full of so much good. I mean, we were a beautiful family. You know, we have a younger sister. My brother and I were the closest, best friends. And it's still filled with all of that. But, you know, I had to deal with all of that past and that trauma. And you do talk about remembering the 2-year-old boy's little face. You know, I always say the mm-hmm. little boy that turned into a man. And I just hope, like, I hope people read it that maybe have never had addiction in their family and just want to read it so that they kind of understand how this could happen. How can somebody become homeless? Or, you know, all those things by reading our story.
Wow. Well, it starts with something that bothers them and they take a little more alcohol than they should because they're soothing themselves. But the alcohol starts to take over. That's the problem. It doesn't stay at that early stage.
It really does. And one of the reasons why I always do speak and why I wanted to, you know, have this open dialogue in my own family and really raise sons and tell my nieces so that they're comfortable talking about it. Because everyone thinks, oh, this could never happen to me. It can happen to anybody. And how many people don't try alcohol? You know, it's everywhere. And as we kiss our children as they go off to college or university, almost all of them will start partying and having a good time, and it's innocent and it's legal. And I just want people to be aware and to respect alcohol. You know, we're told don't do drugs. But I think an important lesson is just respect alcohol. And if you see it getting out of hand, to see some of the signs and get help then.
And not just help for the person who's doing the drinking or the drugs. It's a similar process.
Absolutely. They are all as destructive. They can all ruin families, and they can both end lives. And, yes, for everyone to get help, everyone that surrounds themselves with that person, just to get together. And you know what I say is stay aligned as a family. Agree to disagree, but listen to the advice of the professionals. You know, my family didn't do that. And I can just hope, you know, that my brother knows that I have done this, and that's what he would want for our own family. You know, these tragedies and this, it can bring families closer together. And I think if our loved one has passed, they would want that.
So how can people get this book, or how can they contact you?
Absolutely. Well, I would love to hear from anyone, and so it's available on my website at jodeprouse.com. So it's JodeeProuse, or it's also available on Amazon.com.
Wonderful. Jody, I have such admiration for you for putting this story out there and the way you did it so beautifully. It's really going to touch a lot of people's lives.
Thank you very much. And thanks for all that you do every day. You know, talking and dialogue, it's very, very important.
And just today, I was invited for a crisis management debriefing. Somebody died the night before, like one day before, and people had been with that person and talked to him, and so many people liked him, loved him, and he was gone. So, and it wasn't from alcohol, but it doesn't matter. The grief was intense. So thank you. It's so nice to be able to listen to people, and that's what you're doing for people. You're letting them hear the story, and I know it will touch them, and some of them may reach out to you directly.
Yeah, well, I would love that, and I do hope, you know, to accept and learn and forgive and heal. And it isn't always about addiction, but it can be cancer or Alzheimer's or a divorce. What I know when you start talking is we all feel the same. And, you know, someone out there does know how you feel.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Well, thank you, Jody Prouse, for participating on the radio show. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
You as well. Take good care.
And you too. And I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. I have a free report on one of my websites, healthybabyboomersnetwork.com, how to live to 100 and beyond and be happy and healthy. And if you're interested in virtual summits to find out about men and women, and I have one on healing recovery, just check out my other website, drericagoodstone.com. Look forward to speaking to you again soon.